Sorry. Can I just move this stuff so I can just push this down here? Could somebody get me a glass of water? I've still got this damn cough. 3 months now. I'm counting. Actually, I should have said no to that last one. Paul was on a rant in that chapter. And it was an aside that he made that I was interested in, rather than him bagging off against all of the things that culturally he had a lot of trouble with, like being gay. So, this is part two of my story. And I just want to just re-emphasize, this is my story. I'm not being prescriptive in anything I say here, all right? And if I, you know, if you don't want to talk to me anymore, well, that's cool. One thing that was made very clear to me last time is that I should stop apologising for everything I say and do. So I was going to say I'm really sorry that I... but this time I will not do that. The gloves are off. Okay. So if I catch myself, I'm sure Michael will just...
I'm sorry.
You can throw things. So if you catch me, just give me a nod. At least they're organic tomatoes. Can you hear me well enough?
Yes.
Good. All right. Am I too loud?
No.
It's a joke. It's a joke. All right. Oh, thanks for the water. Okay, my last sermon, I talked about some of the challenges that I've been facing about my faith, and it's great to see that there's a home group for people who have thought, let's sit down and talk through some of these big questions. Sometimes even if you've got no hope of doing the answering, it's the asking that is what nurtures the journey. And I said last time that when I'd started doing that process, that I found a lot of voices cropping up from my past. And often they were critical and judgmental voices saying, Paul, you're straying away. But actually, the thing that bothered me the most was that I was afraid of disappointing you, if I have to be honest. In the event that, for whatever reason, I decided that this wasn't the right path for me. And at the end of the talk, I was really relieved to hear, not brickbats, but support from many of you. So what I want to do, and I really appreciate that, it feels like that it's, I don't have to be right or wrong, that it's, I've just got to be honest, and I want to walk that journey with you guys, if that's okay. That's not an apology. So what I want to do today is to give a brief review of some of the books that I've read that I've found really helpful and illuminating in figuring out what the right questions are to ask. And I'm not sure that I've got there, but it's been a lot of fun, and I've got really excited about just some of the territory that I've got into, and I want to share some of that with you. So I've read a whole bunch of books, but I don't have time to review all of those. And what I really want to do is finish with enough time for us to ask some questions, because what I'm wanting to do is to provoke some conversation about tough stuff. And this is the only place that I can think of actually doing that, to be honest. Here are some of the questions that I've just found really fascinating and interesting. Started from the Bible, got into something about truth and how do you know about truth. Then it got bumped into by Mr. Dawkins. And then you go back, well, where did it all start? And somewhere in that kind of haphazard way, these are the kinds of questions that I wound up bumping into that I've known about, but not really spent much time exploring in any serious way. And as I said last time, the way that I see myself doing this is as a baby sitting in the dirty bathwater. I have no idea which is which. Actually, that's not the right analogy. The idea is not throwing out either one or the other until I know which is which. I'll just think. Okay, let's move along. So here's a smattering of stuff that I've been reading. These are the ones that I want to pick up on. And I encourage you to read this. Even if it's scary and even if you don't understand everything that they say, because it will provoke something in you that raises questions about your faith. And I think that's really important. The first two books are by atheists who are dismissive of any thought of a supernatural reality, with the latter, Richard Dawkins, as I said last week, being openly hostile and, I find, incredibly patronising towards people who believe in God. The next two are also by an atheist, but I have a lot of time for this guy. I've really warmed to Paul Davies. Paul Davies won the Templeton Prize for Advances in Spirituality and Religion in 1995. Given that he's an atheist and a theoretical physicist, that's actually quite an achievement. What does it say something about the judging panel? And the fifth is by someone who was a card-carrying atheist and celebrated philosopher for 50 years before deciding there was a God. And the last, many of you would be aware of Tom Wright, Anglican bishop, biblical scholar, historian. So they're the books that I want to just give a super brief fingernail, thumbnail sketch. And then say, what does that mean? Where does that leave us? Where does that leave me? Andrew, my son, if you're listening to this, I bloody well hope you do eventually. He said he would listen. It was Andrew who gave me this book. And it was a really profound experience to read this book, because it got me to face some things that I found that I was shoving down all of the time. Matthew Alper, it doesn't seem like he was any particularly special, as in celebrated or known person. He just started a journey, a bit like myself. He got a degree in philosophy and had some various life experiences and wound up asking the question, is there a spiritual reality? Is there a God? And this was a best-selling book and has been for a decade or so. And his particular thing was to use science as his toolkit, because he wanted to know how much of spirituality and reality can one explain using science. So he decided disciplines from physics through to biology, and he became convinced that you could actually explain a lot of what people do in the name of faith or spirituality through the scientific lens. He quotes Immanuel Kant, which reminds me of Monty Python, that we are demonstrated with a built-in understanding, for example, of space and time. We're not blank slates when we're born. We know stuff. And his question was, could you apply that to knowledge about God? Could our desire to worship God be physically hardwired? Now, there's a thought. So he then went through and he gave some examples of planarian worms that move instinctively towards a light when you shine a light. And he talked about bees building hexagonal-shaped honeycombs, spiders weaving webs. And he said these are instinctive behaviours, not learned ones. And then he gave examples all the way up the phylogenetic tree of primates courting, foraging, child-rearing. And even smiling is an instinctive response. It's not learnt. He concluded that religious behaviours can all be described neurologically, and that there's no reality of God outside of our own brains. It's a hardwired response that probably came about as a byproduct of natural selection. Well, I was thinking about this, and I'm no expert in this. This is just a layman's kind of way of making sense. And as I said last week, trying to park my faith and all my baggage to one side and just try to be open about this as much as I can. And I thought about the worm. I thought, well, yes, it's true. If you were to fry the light-seeking part of the worm's neural cord, which is what they did, it would no longer seek light. It doesn't have a brain, it just has a neural cord. But you wouldn't then conclude from there that because that worm no longer seeks light, that light doesn't exist. It just seems like a really obvious thing to me. Similarly, if you were to mutilate part of the brain that we knew corresponded with a specific response, then we'd no longer respond in the same way. That's obvious. But my question is, well, what does that prove? If the worm's response to light is hardwired, then surely that's because over evolutionary time, somehow the existence of light has been instrumental in helping that worm survive. So it's not surprising that if you turn the lights out, it doesn't know where it is. And what's more, that it's impacted on its genetic development. And as Fritjof Capra in his book, Everything is Connected with Everything Else, Everything, is that what it's called? No, the hidden Connections. Our DNA is not immune to our environment. It is affected by our environment. So I'm in no position to tell him that he's wrong. But my view is that I think there's a problem here, is that right at the beginning of the book, almost in the first sentence, he says he's already decided there is no supernatural reality. So the problem that I see is that if you've decided that up front, you have already precluded from an open point of view what other reasons might there be for worms orienting themselves towards light, for bees to make hexagonal honeycomb things, or for humans to respond to a god. He's already decided that doesn't exist. To me seems daft. This guy, I talked about him a lot. And as I'm sure you're aware, he doesn't mince his words. He's published heaps of books, but his most famous is The God Delusion, where he rails against the destructive effects of religious fundamentalism. And I can understand that rage at all of the things that have been done in God's name, because I share that rage, as many of us do. Nevertheless, this is a bruising book to read. I just felt like he was whacking me over the head. That you are a dickhead for believing in God. How can you even do that? Having said that, there was another thought that occurred to me, is that I think I do need to harden up. I think we need to harden up. This is an aside. Christians have had this coming for a long time. We've enjoyed a privileged place in Australian society, resting on the myth that this is a Christian country. Well, it hasn't been that for some time. And judging from recent events in the media, the chickens are coming home to roost for certain organisations that have enjoyed state protection until now. In his book, Dawkins dismisses various arguments for God's existence with a wave of his hand, such as Aquinas' proofs, various arguments from beauty and personal experience, and he dismisses all arguments for God, the proof of God, from Scripture. It was amusing to read, "There are still some people who are persuaded by scriptural evidence to believe in God." And I'm thinking, and your point is? I think that says more about Dawkins' ignorance of religion than anything else. One point he does make, which I actually support, and which I think is a scary point to consider, and that is the notion of the God of the gaps. I think many of us, including myself, do this. What does he mean by the God of the gaps? Well, what he's talking about is that. It's an amazing phenomenon to see the Orion Nebula coloured up in a way that allows you to see the furthest things from the light things. And there's a really understandable human reaction that looks at something like that, and for some people to say, well, that proves there is a God because of the wonder and the awe that I experience from seeing those beautiful colours. Or alternatively, ah, yes, that was definitely the work of the Holy Spirit. Just because we don't understand something doesn't mean it's a miracle or that God therefore exists. It could just as easily, and I suspect far more often than we care to admit, could be a gap in our knowledge or experience. For example, what we used to call a demon from the first century New Testament, these days is much more likely to be considered as epilepsy or mental illness. And what we call the Holy Spirit's activity may, in some cases, be no more than us joining the dots to suit our own understanding or circumstances. The problem with always interpreting phenomena, amazing phenomena, as a sign of God's existence is that we are in danger of creating a God based on our own ignorance. And the problem with that is that that kind of God is really vulnerable to learning anything new. It can cause us to stop listening or to shut down intellectually whenever our faith is threatened. And the problem with always spiritualizing events, the brick fell off the window, it hit that person on the head, that is God's judgment. The problem with doing that is that we're in danger of putting our words into God's mouth. And I think we do that a lot. back to Dawkins. His central argument for the book is this, that because he talks about the argument that because the universe is so incredibly complex, that there must be a God. He says that argument doesn't hold up, because a God capable of designing a complex universe must, by definition, be even more improbably complex. You wind up creating more questions than you answer. Now that's scary. This guy with a moustache. It wasn't even Movember when this was taken. Like I said, I have a lot of time for this guy. His scientific credentials, he's a theoretical physicist, are impeccable. He calls himself an atheist, but in reading his books, he carries that view with grace and with openness. It is also scrupulously honest about what he thinks is knowable and what isn't, using science. I recommend both these books. They'll widen your horizons by about 13 billion light years. The Goldilocks Enigma, which is this book here, looks at the way the universe appears just right for life, while the origin of life, which is I'll talk about in a second, focuses specifically on how did life start. So some interesting facts and theories that came out of that book. The Big Bang. Most physicists believe that all the matter in our universe, all of the stars, all of the way stuff happens together can be traced back to a single event, the Big Bang, an infinitesimally, and then double and square and triple it and times it by itself, huge explosion that released enough energy to ultimately create all our stars and planets. The current estimates, based on how far we can see light, is that the universe is 13.7 billion years old. And Tyson, you sent me a link. They've just discovered a nebula that they estimate is 13.4 billion years old. So we're about 400 million years off from seeing point zero. Current estimates are the Earth is about 4.56 billion years old. No one knows what caused the Big Bang or what happened before it, if there was a before it. There is a whole science on was there before it. There's a singularity mathematically that happens at the point of the Big Bang. We appear to have a situation where we have all of the mass and energy of the universe located in a single point containing no space and no time. Blah. That's scary.
That makes things clear.
You thought we had sorted things out. Nothing could be further from the truth, and that's one of the points that I'm trying to make. The second law of dynamics is a pain in the proverbial. It's one of the laws that says that all things tend from order to disorder. Energy starts out clumped and will eventually even out. Now, I'm not a physicist, and if I've got some of those concepts wrong, then please let me know. But in so reading that, as I understand it, it actually answers one of my questions at the beginning of the talk. The universe must have had a starting point. It can't have been there forever in its current state, otherwise all the suns and stars would have burnt out by now. I was very disappointed reading that. We did actually have a beginning. Well, one of perhaps a series of beginnings. But that's another story. The second book that I read just blew me away. It was actually written 5 years earlier, and he asked the question, how did life begin? Now, we've spent a lot of time, Dawkins spends a lot of time saying, once it began, how did it get to where we are now? And I think that's wonderful, and from an Occam's razor and a parsimonious point of view, evolution explains far more than the problems it creates. But if you go back right back to the beginning, how did it all start? That's what he's trying to look at. So consider this, a cell. All living things, as I understand, as I've read, are composed of cells. Even the most simplest organisms are based on a single cell bacteria, have a vague structure like that in the top left-hand corner. What's in a cell is an incredible feat of engineering. Just consider the cell wall. It's a one-way pump. Stuff can get in, but stuff can't get out. depending on the circumstance. And I think, would it be right, sometimes it reverses itself? Sodium pump goes one way or the other. It's incredible. And what's more, there are things that swim around inside of it and they do stuff. It's a factory. It contains amino acids, proteins, enzymes that provide energy for creating molecules. And one of the molecules that it creates, in fact, the most important fundamental molecule it creates is DNA. The double helix. Two complementary long chain molecules, these things going around here, and they're joined together by these base pairs here. And there's a special order to those base pairs based on four molecules: adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. And the order of those pairs determines you. It determines every single bit of you. It determines a whole bunch of stuff. And if you get it wrong, that's a mutation. And most times mutations are bad and they don't wind up with sustainable life forms. All of the information for producing humans or bacteria are stored in the order in which those chemicals are represented. You think about the incredible complexity of that, that molecule there. The cell creates DNA. But where did the cell come from? You need to have DNA coded up to produce a cell in the first place. And this is the nub of the book of the origin of life. Which came first? And as much as I despise the idea of the minimum complexity argument, because evolution explains things like eyeballs really well, but it does not explain the complexity of DNA very well at all. And people have surmised and tried to talk about basic DNA, basic cells. They keep coming up to the same point. As I've read it every time, there is a minimum level where you have to have both working together for them to create and sustain and maintain and develop life. It's incredible. So how did this happen? What are the kinds of explanations people give? Well, most scientists say it happened by chance. What's courageous about Paul Davies is he said, that's a load of bollocks. Even if you take chance, even if you say, pick a large number, and he actually tried to come up with some back of the envelope calculations, there isn't even enough time geologically for this kind of situation to happen, for magically some lightning bolt to fire onto a warm pond of stuff, and remember, it's all inorganic stuff, it's not organic stuff, to create, just by chance, all of the amino acids and to create the DNA coded with enough information so that it can replicate. And you've got to remember, it's the replication that's the killer here. You've got to create something not just gives birth to one thing, but that thing itself remembers the original DNA instructions and carries it on to the next generation impeccably and perfectly. You've got to have all of that for it to maintain itself. If you don't have any of those, you'll have life forms that will dissipate and disappear. What do you do with it? If you're a scientist and you're a naturalist scientist and you're only using science as your tool, what do you do with that situation? Well, most of them dive for cover. Most of them will say it's either by chance, which is really a way of saying, actually, I don't know. And I think Christians have to be very careful not to just jump in and say, oh, well, that proves there's a God. It doesn't. But it is a point at which nobody has, to this stage, a reasonable, logical, defensible, verifiable explanation for how it happened. That just blows me away. People might say, well, if you don't have enough geological time, well, think about all the planets out there, the trillions and billions of planets. Well, Davies went that extra step further and he said, well, estimating the number of planets, in the back of the envelope, multiply that by the original numbers, there's still not enough time. Within the 13.4 billion years, with all of the trillions of planets, from his calculations, to measurably change the odds for this kind of situation to develop by chance. So we have these twin pillars of unknowability. No reasonable, verifiable explanation for why or how matter exists, and equally no verifiable picture for how DNA can exist in conjunction with replicating life and cells and why we exist. All of our knowledge is built on the most absent of important information of how did it all happen, why are we here. That just blows me away. That's why I'm excited. It's not just being Italian. Anthony Flew, I was given his name by Ian Robinson when he was here and preached last time. He was the poster boy for atheism for over 50 years. He was the atheist's atheist, set the agenda for academic study of atheism for many, many years. He was a contemporary of C.S. Lewis. And in 2004, he did the unthinkable. In his 80s, he publicly stated that he'd changed his mind and that he thought there was now a God. Now, he didn't say it was our God. He didn't say it was a personal God. He just said there is a God of some kind. There is a designer. Some kind of supernatural being or force, call it what you will, that designed and created the universe. And why did he get to that point? His primary reason was, and I quote, the apparent impossibility of providing a naturalistic theory of the origin of DNA. And that's where Paul Davies left us. So there you have somebody who's built his entire reputation on saying how logically and philosophically there is no rational argument for supporting the existence of a God. He considers the alternatives and finds that the alternatives are worse. So in his book, he committed professional suicide doing this. He was pilloried, he was lambasted, he was accused of all kinds of things, as you would expect. He left the philosophical atheist world in absolute disarray, and they all regrouped and covered their asses and... Sorry, I shouldn't say that. There is no arse in Christianity. Have said some very terrible things about him. I just take my hat off to him. In the appendix to that book is about a really small chapter where he's in a discussion with Tom Wright. So he's come to this point of there is a God, and he's now asking the next question, well, what kind of God? And Tom Wright starts his conversation up with him. And basically in that small chapter, Tom Wright summarises pretty well everything he said about the resurrection. So why didn't he just say it in just those few words? And what he says about the resurrection, which he's saying in answer to specific questions that Anthony Flew is asking, he said, think about what resurrection meant in the first century. And he said there are a number of misconceptions. And I was aware of none of this, or very little of it anyway. People in Jesus' time did not believe in the resurrection, generally. They either didn't believe it in at all, or if they did, and this was limited within the Jewish people, they believed that when you died, you went to sleep. And you stayed that way until the end of time, and then you woke up again sometime out there. That was if I've read it right, that's what Tom Wright's saying. That was their conception of resurrection, and very few people believe that. Only the Jews believe that, or a small part of the Jewish society. The common ideas about resurrection were that you either got the same body back, if you got anything at all, in other words, all the bits, or you got some kind of disembodied ghostly body. It was the early Christians who were the first to talk of what Paul talks in terms of bodily transformation, that you get a body back. It's a physical body, but it is a changed body, which is what he talks about in Corinthians. The Christians were also the first ones to talk about the Messiah being killed and raised from the dead, and that was a significant departure because until then nobody had thought in terms of the Messiah being killed, much less raised from the dead. Whilst there was a spectrum of views on what the resurrection was like outside of the Christian community, the Christians, from Tom Wright's point of view, had a very specific understanding of what resurrection meant. And it meant dying and physically raising from the dead immediately. And what's more, Wright says, that did not develop 20, 30, 40 years down the track. From what his reading suggests, that view became demonstrated almost immediately. And that leads him to the conclusion that something happened. Now, that might not be much. And he then goes on and says, well, I can tell you what it was that happened. But most people have been, particularly within the Jesus Seminar community, been very dismissive of the notion of a physical resurrection. And what Tom Wright is saying is that even using the plain historian's tools, it is really clear something amazing and incredible happened that caused a whole bunch of people to radically change their worldview in a way that has been sustained till the present day. And that was without precedent at the time. He gets very excited by the very things that cause some people to get nervous. He loves the untidiness of the narrative. He loves the inconsistency of the guy. Scott's yawning. That means I'm talking to him. I've only been talking for 20 minutes. Oh, sorry, Scott. That was a... Oh, look, I'll make it up to you afterwards. Yeah. And also the role of women as the very first witnesses. He said, from a historian's point of view, that is gold. The early Christians would have never made that up, not in a million years. Summarising all of that, coming back to Flew, he says that what Wright has said was the most compelling argument that he'd ever heard in defence of a physical resurrection. At the time, he called it fresh and original, which is, I think what he meant was amazing and mind-blowing, but he's a philosopher and he's English, so he called it fresh and original. He died only a couple of years ago, and his motto, the thing that has always brought with him for his entire life, was, I have to go where the evidence leads. That was his mantra. I have to go where the evidence is. He was not working on the basis of faith. He was working on the basis of, how do I make sense, the best sense with what I see, using the best tools that we have available. None of it's perfect, but given the best that we have, where am I being pointed? I have to go. I cannot just hang on to here because I'm invested for whatever reason in here. And he was heavily invested. And nevertheless, he went where the evidence led. So where does that leave us? Just summarising, there is no good handle on what the Big Bang is about, why it happened, how it happened, or what. And as I've already said, that both the naturalistic and the supernaturalistic explanations for our existence have big holes, because all of them create more questions. There is no single explanation, whether it's from a Christian faith point of view or from a purely naturalistic point of view. They are all ultimately unable to explain how it all started in a verifiable way using the tools. Somewhere along the way, you have to make a jump of faith. And this is where the faith thing kicks in. One of the most important things that I want to say is that we all live in a conundrum. Nobody has the monopoly on the truth. And whilst people have always said that about Christians, I think the same has to be said about scientists. We should not, as people of faith, should not be cowed or intimidated by people like Dawkins who say we have no reasonable explanation for why things are the way they are. Our worldview of positing a God, a designer God, is as good an explanation as anything that any scientist can throw at you. They are all statements of faith because none of us were there, none of us have the tools to understand what is at time zero. We should all be working together. And yet what I see by the very language that both sides use is creating a false dichotomy. You've either got faith or you've got science. What a load of nonsense. So, as I've said, I'm blown away by this. I feel for the naturalist scientists. They are faced with an awful possibility that the only reasonable explanation might include a spiritual component. But the Christians don't get off easily. We've been too quick to resort to the God of the gaps, trying to create our own certainty rather than just sit in the mystery of what we don't know. But for me, that's not the end of the story. There are many sources of knowledge. One of them is the New Testament. And for me, it tells a unique story of a man in history. And I hope this doesn't sound like a non sequitur. For me, it follows. His life and his death and his apparent resurrection change history overnight in a way that Tom Wright says affords only one reasonable explanation, that the story of Jesus and his resurrection actually happened. By taking on that story, We're invited to see the world in a different way. And for me, that's actually the best way that I can make the jump between, well, actually, we don't know how it started, to, well, why be a Christian? For me, I see it in terms of, well, you've got to make a choice somehow. You've got to try and make sense of this conundrum somehow. And there are a variety of lenses of seeing these apparent incredible things and trying to make sense of them. And what I read through the story of Jesus is an invitation to see things through his life. And as I said, this is where faith kicks in. I don't think, and to answer another question that I had at the beginning, how far can science and rationality take us? Well, I don't think it can take me any further. Because the discussion about is there a God is ultimately not one about proof. You can't prove is there a God. You can't prove is there not a God. We don't have the tools to do that. All we can do is follow an invitation to see things differently. So how would that work? So I've had a beautiful sunset here. Next time we see a sunset like that, how about we just sit in the moment and accept that it's beautiful and not try to read more into it than that? And I'll try and say something. I hope this makes sense. For me, there is a miracle here. But the miracle is not that the sunset is beautiful and therefore there is a God. The miracle for me is that anything is beautiful in the first place. The more I think about it, the more it seems that beauty is about seeing the world in a certain way. You could miss that beauty if you saw it in a different way. But by trying on the lens of Christianity, we might actually suspect that this beauty might have something to do with this idea of God. And if we then take on board at faith the story in Genesis about God's image being within us, it should not surprise us that we get swept up into the colours of the cosmos. To say that beauty doesn't exist, which is where Dawkins' logic leads us, is to be blind to what it means to be human, I suggest. So we all need each other. The Christians need the scientists desperately to stop us from inventing God out of our own enthusiasm and ignorance. But equally, scientists desperately need people of faith so that in their enthusiasm to understand, they don't kill the very thing they're examining. We should each learn to walk humbly and learn from each other. I love that little guy. No, it's not David or Andrew. So where does that leave me? Well, there's a choice in this, and I really appreciate the email that Claire sent me during the week. There's a choice in this for me. I could have been born a Hindu or a Muslim, but I wasn't. I was born here. And so I'm making a choice, for better or worse, to try on and see through the lens of Jesus. Like Davies and Flew, I find the argument for design absolutely compelling. But I can't say much more about that designer just from logic and rationality, except through this. When I look at the earth, I see life abundant. Everywhere I look, life pokes through the cracks. In the most hostile situations, when the conditions of life are right, life replicates itself on an almost extravagant, wasteful scale. It's everywhere when, by rights, it shouldn't exist at all. Should also say that although you can't prove there is a God, and it wouldn't make any difference even if you could, there is this, the remarkable resurrection event. And to follow up on a point that Michael Bell made to me a little while ago, for over 2,000 years, there's a great cloud of witnesses that have wrestled and struggled with this question, and that's not something to be sneezed at. I recognise that. So at this stage, I would describe my faith as a working hypothesis. Looking through the lens of Jesus seems to me to make best sense of the world. Now, I know there are gaps, but I don't have a better alternative. And to follow this journey with any integrity, I need, on the one hand, to live as if that's true, while on the other, not rejecting any new insight or information, wherever it comes from. So in the words of Flew, I need to follow where the evidence leads. The journey continues. It's not 11 o'clock.
It is. And I'm going to exercise service leaders right here.